Genetic testing was once reserved for medical purposes, but now you can buy a kit, swab your cheek, and find out about your DNA. Today, the growing popularity of DNA testing and what we can learn from it. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. More than 2 million people have tested their own DNA using kits sold for home use. This hour, I'll talk to two women who used the tests and learned surprising things about themselves and their families. I'll also talk with Bryant McAllister, who teaches a course called Who Are You? Revelations from the Personal Genome at the University of Iowa, and Jennifer Ewing of the Iowa Genealogical Society. Join the conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. DNA testing is now accessible to pretty much anyone who has about $100 to spare. Home DNA testing kits have become extremely popular. And this hour, we'll talk about how they work and what we can learn from them. If you've used one of these kits and learned something about your family, we'd love to hear your story and, of course, answer your questions. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Karen Kopp of Iowa City is my first guest today. She used one of these kits a while back. Good morning, Karen.
Good morning.
And what led you to buy a DNA testing kit?
Well, my husband is good friends with Bryant McAllister, who'll be on the show later.
Right.
Or with us in just a moment. And Bryant was describing the kits and how they use them in a seminar. And so my husband was very curious, and he did the test. And I felt like I waited to take the test because I thought I already knew everything about my family. We have extensive family trees that go back to, you know, the 16th century. So I thought, but then it just got to me, and I was curious. So I went ahead and bought a kit for myself and my mother.
All right. And so you did learn that you didn't know everything about your family. And one of the things, and we'll talk more about this in just a moment, but one of the things that these tests can do is link you with other people who share some of your genetic background. So your relatives. You took the test and you did get matched with someone. Tell me what happened.
Yeah. So I sent in my test at the end of April, and then at the end of May, I had an email from someone who was a close match. They were identified as a cousin within 23andMe. And 23andMe has a interior email system where you can contact people without revealing who you are. So it can be private. So when that person who looked like a cousin contacted me, I was sort of – it just caught me by surprise because I thought – what? You know, and I didn't know of any, I didn't know who this could be. And then because I had also sent in a kit for my mother and I could see my mother's reports and mine, then I realized it wasn't a first cousin. It was a first cousin once removed. So that meant she was the daughter of one of the 22 cousins on my mother's side.
Okay. And you have a lot of cousins.
I do. Yeah.
But she was interested in getting in touch with you because...
because she was adopted.
All right. She was looking for her birth mother.
Yes.
Which had to be one of your 22 cousins.
Yes.
And
yes.
Did you have any idea before you got a message from her that any of your cousins had given up a child?
I didn't. No. No. So then I talked to my two younger sisters and we were speculating, you know, like, who could this be? And I was also, I talked to, you know, all of my friends who would listen to say, well, I don't know what to do.
And were you worried that you were opening up a can of worms?
Yes. Yes. I didn't want to turn someone's life upside down if this wasn't something that they wanted to be out there. And I exchanged a few emails with April, who is the young woman who had been adopted, and she had learned a year earlier what her birth mother's name was. So then at that point it was easy, and I could also tell from 23andMe by the percentage of genetic material that we shared, that she was a first cousin once removed. So that helped too.
Right. So once you connected the dots and you knew which cousin had given her up for adoption, still you have information that you weren't necessarily supposed to have. And
right.
It wasn't a simple thing. It was pretty complicated.
Yes, because the April's birth mother was mentally ill and was in an institution. So I contacted one of the cousins in that family, and we talked by phone, and there was this dilemma of this information. We felt the information belonged to April, who her birth mother was, but then at the same time, it was terrible news to give her that that her mother was, you know, in an institution.
Right.
But then I felt that it wasn't – I was excited about it, of course, when I first heard from April. But mm-hmm. I knew it wasn't my information to share. So my cousin decided that, you know, she wanted to get in touch with April. And so then she contacted my cousin Linda, who's the birth mother, and asked her if it was okay to get in touch with April. And it was. Okay. So then from that point on, the two sisters of Linda were in touch with April.
So her aunts.
Yes, her aunts.
Her biological aunts.
Mm-hmm.
And your cousin, who was institutionalized, also became very ill, and she was put into hospice care.
Yeah.
What happened next?
Well, so the timeline for this is interesting because I sent my test in at the end of April. April, the person, got in touch with me at the end of May. And then toward the end of June, I contacted my cousins. And then my cousin Linda actually died last week on the 28th.
Oh.
So my cousins had been in touch with April and were able to somehow all decide to – when Linda went into hospice care, then they all tried to get out to – Miami, and they got there, but only April got there. Well, I guess my other cousin got there half an hour before Linda died, but April was able to spend the day with Linda before she died.
Wow.
And I don't think that Linda was responsive, but at least it was,
a moment of closure.
A moment of closure, and just this sort of strange thing that April was there at. With her mother when she was
right.
born, and then also at the very end of her life.
So have you had a chance to talk to April about what that means to her to have made these connections?
Well, I've only emailed with her because I felt that it was her aunts. I wanted them to, have first
right.
contact, although everyone in my family is so excited about, a new relative. We didn't know when my cousin was institutionalized. We just didn't really know a lot about what was going on in her life. I've only been in touch with April through email, but my mother has been in touch with her, and my mother would be her great aunt. And so my mother is saying, like, send her a picture, send her this, send her that, and she sounds like a wonderful young woman, and her two aunts are delighted
right.
to know their niece, and she looks so much like her birth mother Linda, so that's kind of startling too. So April is I think she had been searching for a long time, and so she was very, very happy to learn who her birth mother was, and she actually knew a bit about the mental illness because she could see the medications that the birth mother was on when she gave her up for adoption.
Okay, so she suspected that there was
yeah.
this history.
Yeah.
And so this story is really still unfolding, but what
yeah.
an amazing connection that really you couldn't have made in any other way.
No. And what's strange is that April was searching for her birth mother, and I just took the test kind of on a whim, you know, just out of curiosity. And so it was, I guess the thing is, you know, you might have a family tree, but it just emphasized that point that perhaps not everything is on it, right? Or everyone.
And did you learn anything else that was surprising about your history that you didn't know already?
Well, I know that with 23andMe, you have, they give you a country breakdown of how your genetic material matches up with the people who have settled in other countries. And Bryant will explain this better.
Right.
But I think that I had a bigger, I identify so much with my mother's side of the family. And then it's like, but you have a bigger percentage of Scandinavian. So I didn't learn anything too surprising. But there are all these small percentages of things that are different from my breakdown and my mother's. And I just think, hey, what about that?
You know?
And,
well, that's interesting. We'll talk about genealogy later in the hour as well. And so often when someone spends a lot of time researching genealogy, it's someone from one side of your family and not the other.
Exactly.
And so you might feel like you have this very rich history on the one side, but there may be some surprises on the other.
Yeah, a little bit of Finnish.
Right. Well, I'm talking with Karen Kopp of Iowa City, her story about taking one of these home DNA tests. And I want to bring Bryant McAllister into the conversation. He's an associate professor of biology at the University of Iowa. He teaches a course called Who Are You? Revelations from the Personal Genome. Hello, Bryant.
Hello. How are you?
Good. Thank you so much for being here today. And we have just a moment before we get to the break. But how long have you been interested in these kinds of kits, these kinds of tests?
Well, I'm a professor of biology, and I've been teaching genetics and evolution for a while. And so I've been keeping up with what's happening in relation to these personal genetic tests. But I really only got into it at the start of 2014 when I had started planning to offer a first-year seminar course on personal genomics for first-year students here at the University of Iowa. And so there I just sort of really immersed myself into figuring out what the different companies offer, which test would be appropriate to offer to students in a class, where I use their test results essentially as a framework for teaching genetics and evolutionary principles to them.
And it must seem almost miraculous to have this kind of information at your fingertips after a lifetime of teaching about genetics.
Right. And so it's really, it makes genetics different whenever you can really translate it to yourself. And so you can see inheritance, for instance, in Karen's case, where she has her mother's sample and her sample there, you know, you can do directly the comparison between your mom and you to see what regions you share and what regions are different. If you have a grandparent in there, you can make those comparisons as well. And so it brings genetics to light in terms of your own genetic makeup.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm talking with Bryant McAllister, associate professor of biology at the University of Iowa. Karen Kopp is also here of Iowa City. We're talking about home DNA testing. And if you have a story to share, we'd love to hear it. 866-780-9100. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about DNA testing kits. They've become very accessible to people. There are a number of different companies that offer them for around $100. You get a kit and you can test yourself, send it in, and learn about your family history, your genetic background. I was talking with Karen Kopp earlier of Iowa City about her personal story and using one of these tests. With me right now is Bryant McAllister, associate professor of biology at the University of Iowa, who teaches a seminar called Who Are You? Revelations from the Personal Genome. And Brian, we learned about what Karen learned from this test, but can you give me more of a general idea of exactly what kind of information you can gather from taking one of these tests?
So the general reports that they get from your genetic data, and most of these companies are really using the same platform in terms of analyzing your DNA and then looking at those particular variants and determining which variant you have. The reports you get, you can get the breakdown of your ancestry composition. And so, as Karen mentioned, geographic history in terms of you know, the proportion that of your genetic variation that's associated with, say, Great Britain or with Ireland or Northern Europe or Scandinavia, and so some kind of geographic breakdown. It's called admixture analysis. So this is a case of sort of what mix of geographic variation are you enriched for in terms of your evolutionary history, your family history, by comparing you to reference samples. The other thing that they will generally report is how you match with others. And so, as Karen mentioned in her test, this DNA relative feature of 23andMe is a case of taking your sample and matching it with all other customers in the database that have enabled themselves to be matched with, and then identifying if the match is similar with being a first cousin, second cousin, so on. And generally that'll work within, say, 5 to 6 generations out in terms of being able to identify genetic matches.
And you mentioned 23andMe. There are, in just a quick search online, I noticed there are lots of companies that do this. There are kind of two leading companies that do this, the 23andMe and AncestryDNA.com. And they both have databases now that are more than 1 million people, right?
Correct. And so Ancestry is mostly in relation to genealogical research. And so the DNA test is highly integrated with trees that would be developed in Ancestry.com. And they're, in addition to matching you with relatives, they search between the user's trees and identify potential common relatives that may be the source of that genetic match between the customers. And so there you're really linking together the genealogical research and what's there in family trees and then the genetic data in terms of how individuals are matching with one another and what the estimation of the relationship is. The Genographic Project has been doing these kind of tests for over 10 years, they're mostly focused on the ancestry composition reports in identifying geographic relationships of you and your particular composition in terms of, say, you know, in European origins versus Asian origins, so on and so forth.
Now, obviously, in Karen's case, she was able to identify a first cousin once removed. That sounds very accurate. How much do we know about the accuracy of these tests?
Well, in the case of close relatives, because the way that the tests are designed in terms of they're really doing a very broad survey of your genetic information. They're looking at variants at about, you know, 700,000 different points within your genome. And so these are just bases of DNA. It's known that these particular points are variable within the human population, and they're determining your particular variant at each of these 700,000 different sites. That's distributed throughout all of your different chromosomes that DNA is contained in, and therefore, if you have a close match, these are very, very good at detecting that close relationship and accurately estimating, for instance, in Karen's case, a first cousin once removed. And so, you know, within a couple of generations, it's going to very accurately call the relationship. Beyond that, the accuracy of those estimates are going to get more broad. They're going to be less accurate once you get beyond, say, 5 generations or so.
Okay, so the further back you go, the more misty things get.
Well, it's really because of genetic principles, is because the more this randomness and transmission of genetic information from generation to generation, you're less likely to inherit a piece of DNA from a common ancestor whenever you consider, you know, 6 or 7 generations
right
back. And so your accuracy of then determining a relationship from 2 descendants from that ancestor is also going to reflect that randomness on, well, you could share something with this descendant through that common ancestor, or you may not, in terms of making that estimate.
And, of course, these are private companies, so they don't share their databases with each other, right?
Correct.
So if you're looking for someone, you might want to go with more than one company.
Well, on the ancestry websites or the genealogy websites, they generally talk about fishing in all the ponds. And so a lot of people are taking tests at multiple companies. So the customer base between 23andMe, Ancestry, and another company that's very popular is Family Tree DNA, where they're mostly genealogy-oriented, as many people will test at each of those different places. And I tend to run into matches looking for genealogical connections that they've tested in these multiple places.
Now, as I mentioned earlier, DNA testing was once a medical procedure. And of course, now it can be done for fun and for personal information. I can imagine that there are some people who would like to take sort of a shortcut through the medical procedure and find out things about health traits. Is there anything that they can do with these tests that can tell them about that?
Well, 23andMe started as a company that was using the genetic data and reporting health-related information. That was their original business model whenever they formed. In fall of 2013, the FDA made them stop that. And so the FDA sent a letter to 23andMe making them stop giving the health reports to their customers. And so from that point on, they mainly became a genealogy and ancestry company. The number of sales declined a little bit after the FDA's action towards 23andMe. They've been working to get permission by the FDA to provide the health reports. In the meantime, there's some third-party sites that you can use to get the health reports from your 23andMe data. You can download it from their website. You can then upload it to a third-party analysis site and then get similar health reports as 23andMe was reporting.
Okay.
And so, yeah, so you can still access your own data. You can make interpretations in relation to what's known for traits that are affected by particular genetic variants. And 23andMe provides a browser that you can look through your genetic data and see, you know, how you would expect your traits to look like based on your genetic data once you know that relationship between what we call the genotype, the genetic data, and the phenotype, the way things look.
But the FDA is recommending that you turn to your doctor for information like that, right?
Right. And so it's mostly the case that they're concerned about people overreacting right. In relation to a particular test result. And so in the case of a test result that says you have a higher incidence of the occurrence of, say, breast cancer, of then sort of having an overreaction in relation to that and this particular procedure not going through FDA approval process in terms of giving that particular information to the customer.
I'm talking with Bryant McAllister, Associate Professor of Biology at the University of Iowa. We're talking about these home DNA testing kits. And I want to bring Mary De La Garza into the conversation now of Long Grove, Iowa. And she has also tested herself more than once, in fact. Mary, thank you so much for being here today.
I'm happy to be here.
Now, what led you to pick up one of these kits in the first place?
I was doing some ancestry research, and I came across something really interesting in that I found that the name De La Garza, which is my father's name, was also on my mother's side of the family. And that was very odd for us because there were a lot of things about the De La Garza family that my mother was not very happy with. And we always heard the derogatory things. So I wanted to figure out exactly how those two sides came together. It was my great-great-grandmother was on my mother's side as well. And I talked to a friend of mine, Lynn Alex, and she said that if I didn't buy one, a DNA test, that she was going to buy one for my birthday. And my birthday came around, and I got it. I took the test and was shocked beyond belief because I was told, and my family was told our whole lives, that we were Spanish and English, and that was pretty much it. And we could trace our ancestry back to Spain, which we can. And I also looked at the English part, but when I got my DNA test back, I found that I was 23% Native American, which was huge. It was huge to us. And I was flabbergasted, and I also found out that I wasn't very Spanish either. I was it came out to 14% Iberian Peninsula and then 33% Greek-Italian, which we had no idea of either. And we had all of these elaborate stories in our family about who came from where and what they did and all of those kinds of things. And it all sort of just fell apart at that point.
So when you got those results, you were shocked, but did you even believe them?
I didn't. In some ways I did because, you know, I've got a scientific head and I thought, well, there are some things that are going to be correct. It's DNA testing. I investigated the company before I even started doing ancestry work with them. And then I decided, well, I need to figure this out for sure. So I got my brother to take a test and I also got my cousin to take a test. And then their results were surprising because my brother's test, he came out with more Native American in his, which was, I think, 25%. But my cousin and I were very similar. I mean, almost identical, which now we're really questioning. That was very bizarre. Of course, it can happen. We're an old Texas family. You know, there's a lot of intermarrying there. I mean, we were – part of my family was in Texas in the 1600s, well, what Texas is now. And, you know, a lot of the families just got married and stayed in the same place.
They were smaller communities back then.
Right, absolutely. But it was just so bizarre. And there were so many other things that came up. There were some rumors that on my father's side of the De La Garza family, that Felipe, who came from Spain in the 1600s, was actually Jewish, but had changed his name because of the Spanish Inquisition at the time from Falcón to De La Garza because that area of Spain that he was named for was Jewish and there were a lot of persecutions. So that was interesting. But through the DNA test, I found out that, yeah, I do have that in my DNA. So that's probably true.
So given this genetic makeup, that means that there were a lot of stories that were not being passed down in your family. So how did you go about trying to find those?
Well, most of the old folks in my family have passed. And so that was the hardest part, was that we knew there were no people that we could actually ask. We have one Aunt Bessie, who was my mother's sister-in-law, who is still living. And I called her up and said, Aunt Bessie, did you know we had Native American ancestry? And she said, no, you're Spanish. And she's in her 80s now, and she just kept saying, I know you're Spanish. I know that my husband is Spanish. And then she said, he always was a little dark, though. And that's just hilarious.
So have you been able to figure out where this comes from?
Not yet. Because I took several tests. I did the Ancestry.com test and then the tribe's DNA, which came back with a Apachean match, which was really interesting. I'm not sure how good that test was or not, but because of where I am from, South Texas, that area had lots of Apachean groups there. So it's possible. I'm looking through records and those kinds of things to try to find someone who has the same Native American background. And I think I found someone. I haven't heard back from them yet, but in their DNA makeup, they had more Native American than Iberian Peninsula. So they may know a little bit more about themselves than I do.
So how does this information change how you think about yourself and your family?
It actually did change how I felt. It was kind of... If to understand the part of Texas that I grew up in, there's a lot of prejudice and good. To give you an example, I'm going to use a slur that that I heard a lot when I was growing up. If you were Spanish or Mexican, if you were Spanish, then you were a white girl and you were called names by the people that were more Mexican-American, which was a name like Bolillo, which means white bread, or Huera, which means white. And I got that a lot when I was growing up. I'm very pale. My family's really pale looking. We don't really have the mestizo look. And it was almost as if I was kind of harassed for not being Mexican and harassed for not being Anglo all the way also. So those things fell away. But then I thought, I had no identity all of a sudden. I grew up thinking, you know, we're Spanish. This is who we come from. We're this really cool Spanish family that's got the coin here of Texas. And, you know, your great-great-great-great-grandfather was the first, you know, mayor. And we have politicians and all of these things in our family. But then all of a sudden I felt like I didn't have that anymore. And that was sort of glorious, you know, right. The thing that your family talks about.
That doesn't make that not true.
No, it just meant that I wasn't what I was told. And so it brought a lot of confusion into me. It really did. And to my brother and my cousin also, because of the how you identify. I'd like identifying more with the Native American piece also, which is really neat. And I'm so excited about that. But then there's that part where it says, well, then you're one part, but there's this other piece. So how do you bring the two together? Right.
Right. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm talking with Mary De La Garza of Long Grove, Iowa, and Bryant McAllister is here, Associate Professor of Biology at the University of Iowa. We're talking about DNA testing, home DNA testing, and what you can learn about yourself and your family. We'll also talk about genealogy in just a few minutes, and we want to hear from you, your stories and your questions. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about DNA testing. Home DNA tests have become very popular. Millions of people have used them to find out more about themselves and their families. And you're welcome to join our conversation at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And with me, Bryant McAllister, Associate Professor of Biology at the University of Iowa. I've also been talking with Mary De La Garza of Long Grove about her personal story, Karen Kopp of Iowa City about her personal story of using one of these tests. And I also want to get to the phones here, and we'll move on to genealogy in just a moment as well. But Kate is on the line in Bettendorf. Hi, Kate.
Hello.
Hi, what's your question?
Okay, my question is, my husband and I did genealogy tests through 23andMe. I was raised with the knowledge that my grandmother was half American Indian. All the pictures show that, and when I got the test back, I'm kind of confused that it showed less than 1% Native American. So I was wondering if anybody had any information about the accuracy about that.
All right. Well, Bryant, do you have any input on that?
Well, I mean, the test as estimated, I mean, if you think that you have a very high percentage and it's coming out that really you don't have any or 1% Native American, that's a case where it's likely that maybe the family story isn't quite accurate. As we heard in Mary's case, her genetic tests ultimately revealed a very surprising result in relation to the family history and the story that was told. If it's really not detecting very much Native American ancestry, it may be the case that the genetic data doesn't support the family story. I mean, in my case, for instance, the test on Genographic Project predicts a 2% Native American match. That's not observed in any of the other analyses of myself or of my parents. And so you can get a little bit of difference from one company to the other for low matches. But if it's the case that, you know, you have a fairly close relative that that was of Native American ancestry, the test really should pick up that, giving rise to a high percentage, such as the 25% or so that Mary indicated in terms of her Native American ancestry.
Well, and it is very interesting to think about the stories that we tell, because there are many people who desire to have Native American background, and these stories get passed along, even if they're not necessarily true. And then there are people who've hidden those stories as well. I mean, Bryant, did you find anything interesting when you ran your test?
Well, I didn't find anything that intriguing in terms of my ancestry composition. Most of our genealogical records for our family indicate fairly early colonization of North America from the British Isles, and most of my ancestry composition and that of my parents comes out as Northern European or Great Britain, Ireland, and so that kind of match. I have done a specialized test. This is one where I've tested my Y chromosome. The Y chromosome is unique. It's transmitted from father to son to son to son to son, and so that particular chromosome traces your paternal lineage back generation after generation after generation. So there's a general interest in looking at how that paternal transmission of the Y chromosome fits with surname. And so because of paternal transmission of the surname, paternal transmission of the Y chromosome, those really should fit together. And my last name is McAllister. And so I was hoping to find genetic matches with other men with Y chromosomes that were similar to mine that also had McAllister surnames. When I got my test results back, most of my close matches to my Y chromosome are some form of the Irwin surname. Huh. And so I'm not a very good McAllister in terms of my genetic matches.
That's interesting. And you don't know why that is yet?
Presumably somewhere back in Ireland, or maybe even in England, there was a change in surname. And through an adoption or illegitimacy, somehow it's what's called a non-paternity event, that there was some change in surname where McAllister was the adopted surname for my particular family.
Interesting. I want to bring Jennifer Ewing into the conversation. She's the executive director of the Iowa Genealogical Society in Des Moines. Hello, Jennifer.
Good morning, Charity.
Oh, thank you so much for being here. And of course, people have been doing genealogical research for a very long time. And in the last few decades, there have been some major steps forward as far as having tools that we can use to research our genealogy. The internet is incredibly powerful in so many ways for that. How do you feel about these DNA tests? Where does that fit into the kinds of research that you do?
They are another tool in our toolbox. DNA testing will never replace good, solid research, but it can help people break through brick walls if they're stuck and they go to Ancestry or 23andMe and they make a match with a second or third cousin that they didn't know about who might have another piece of the puzzle, and they can advance their research past brick walls. But people also need to be prepared for unexpected results, such as the family stories weren't quite true, a non-paternity event, and those can be very emotionally challenging for people.
Do you have people that you have assisted in their research who have used these tests to try to get more information?
Yes. One woman comes to mind. She was adopted. She did research. She matched somebody in, I believe it was Ancestry, and reached out to them and was able to find more information about her birth father. Other people have used it when they're just stuck someplace. We had a gentleman do a Y-DNA test and was able to trace his lineage back to England and to the actual town where his ancestors came from.
Well, and just hearing Bryant's story makes me think that it could be incredibly powerful if you do hit one of those brick walls, if you're looking for a name and the name leads you in the wrong direction.
That's very true.
Have you done one of these tests?
I have not. Probably because I would be really boring.
Well, it's funny because Mary has been telling me for months that I should do one of these tests, and I tell her the exact same thing. I'm fairly certain I'll be very boring, but Mary, you thought you'd be pretty boring too, right?
Exactly.
Well, and I mean, Karen, when you decided to take the test, you thought it wasn't going to show you anything either.
Right. I thought I knew everything there was to know.
Fascinating. Well, John is on the line in Waterloo. Hi, John.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What's your question?
Well, I tell you what, I've had my DNA run through 23andMe. And you get so much information back, and I'm a little confused by all of it. The ancestry thing. I've had some people contact me that are, like, genetic ancestors or genetic relatives, and then I tried to contact other people that look like they're genetic relatives, and I'm just kind of confused, and I wonder if there's a local resource someplace, maybe in Waterloo or Blackhawk County, that I could go and talk to some people there to kind of straighten this out or make it a little more clear in my mind, because it is just, to me, a little overwhelming.
Right. Well, Bryant, I'll let you take a shot at that first. Do you have any advice?
Well, I think that, you know, the caller mentions the big problem is that, you know, generally in the public, you know, knowledge of genetics is not that strong. And these tests are really based on very firm genetic principles. And so oftentimes it's sort of hard to wrap your head around these pages and pages and pages of DNA relatives. And so what does it mean when I go to the DNA relative that's on the, you know, sixth page and is estimated to be a sixth cousin? How much stake should I put in that in order to try to find who may be the connecting relative? Resources, most of the resources out there are developed by the companies. And so each of the major companies has some resources. But, you know, those are a little bit hard to navigate. There's other websites that are available, a lot of blogs available from different genetic genealogists that have learning tools out there that you can use to find more about how to utilize this information. But yeah, I can understand that what's being reported in these sites can be quite overwhelming in terms of, you know, how do I actually utilize this? This is partly my interest in looking at these companies, is to use this as an educational platform, because to me, you know, over a couple million people have now tested, this now brings a lot of the public into learning more about genetic and evolutionary principles. And so to me, it's really a nice learning platform where you can learn and begin to make more and more and more sense of what's being reported.
Well, and Jennifer, do you have people coming to you with similar questions to John, saying, okay, I did this and there's a lot of information, but I don't know how to use it?
Yes, we do. And we have some volunteers that are well-versed in it. So if you call us and make arrangements ahead of time, we can connect you with somebody that can help you. I was going to suggest to John that he contact his local county genealogical society, because they may have somebody who's done it and understands it a little better and may be able to help him.
All right. So look for Blackhawk County Genealogical Society and maybe get started there, John. And if not, then call ahead and plan a trip to Des Moines, maybe. We have some information from Helen, an email from Helen. She says, a few years back, we had my brother's DNA swabbed through the 23andMe service. This was back when they provided health information. We had our brother do the swab so that we could get information on both sides of our family. And she says it's disappointing that they don't do that anymore. She said there were no surprises about our ancestry, but we have had a number of hits from others who are genetically related to us. And Bryant, yesterday on Talk of Iowa, we spent the hour talking about embryo donation and embryo adoption. And this morning we were talking about some of the implications of some of the modern technology that is used to help people overcome infertility and how that will be related to this DNA test. So I can imagine a lot of people are finding half-siblings if they were produced through the help of a sperm donor and things like that. Are you looking into those kind of uses?
So, I mean, that would be a place that you could potentially track down a sperm donor. If a sperm donor has a close relative that's in a database, it would be similar to an adoptee tracking down a biological parent. In this case, you know, if a person that has been a sperm donor has a close relative that's in one of these databases, it's going to be quite revealing. And as more and more people get tested, sort of your biological identity in terms of being anonymous is going to be quite hard to hide.
And speaking of things that are hard to hide, I'm sure there are people that are nervous about these kind of tests on the basis of privacy concerns. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, you know, everybody's genome, everybody's DNA is unique. And so, you know, having that information there, you know, if the information is associated with you, you know, through the DNA match, your identity can ultimately be revealed. There was a story that came out in the spring of law enforcement using one of these public databases in order to investigate a particular murder case. And so that's a case that potentially is concerning in terms of, you know, are these databases of genetic information where you can choose to hide your identity? Is it the case that, you know, having your sample there or having a sample of a close relative then makes you as a suspect because of a genetic match in a criminal case?
Hmm. So if you are concerned about privacy, maybe
privacy is an issue, and it should always be something a person should think about before submitting a test.
All right. And Mike is on the line from Winterset. Hi, Mike. Oh, Mike is not there from Winterset. All right. we do have another call that we'll try to get on the line. But we are nearly out of time this hour. And Jennifer, I'd love to hear from you. I mean, what do you feel like the implications are for genealogical research with the kind of technology that we have available with these tests?
It's just one more tool. It will never replace good, solid research. And it's only, you know, when you submit it to that company, your relatives have also submitted their information. So you're still missing parts without that research.
Okay. So as these databases grow, of course, your chances for a hit are higher, but you're saying don't put all your eggs in that basket.
That's correct.
All right. And Bryant, I mean, these databases are growing dramatically. What do you see as the future of this kind of testing?
That to me is unclear. I mean, they've been growing quite rapidly recently, and it doesn't appear to be slowing down anytime soon. You know, the future, something we mentioned in terms of biological identity, that's going to be hard to hide as these databases get larger and larger and larger. And someone that is relatively close to you is likely to be in one of these databases.
And for people who are getting, we don't want to endorse any private company, but for people who are getting excited about this kind of thing and they want to do it, what kind of things do they need to consider before they choose which company they want to go with?
Well, I tend to suggest that you really evaluate why you want to do it. So what do you want to get out of the result? They are different in terms of how they use your data and what they report from your data, and really make your decision on, you know, as anything you would purchase, you know, what is it that I want to get out? Does this fit that goal the best? I'm oftentimes asked, what's the best? Well, it really depends on what your interest is, and there are differences in what they are reporting.
All right. Bryant McAllister, thank you so much for being here today.
You're welcome.
Bryant McAllister is an associate professor of biology at the University of Iowa. Jennifer Ewing, thank you.
Thank you.
Jennifer Ewing is executive director of the Iowa Genealogical Society in Des Moines. Karen Kopp, thank you for being here and sharing your story. It'll be interesting to see it unfold over the next few months. And Mary De La Garza, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese, Claire Roth, Lindsay Moon, and Emily Woodbury. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. I'm Charity Nebbe. Tomorrow it's Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.